Welcome to Nationalist Public Radio, Words from the End of the West, with your hosts, Everett Foster, Roderick Kane, James Price, and Brett Stevens.
Hey everybody, welcome to Nationalist Public Radio. My name is Everett Foster. I'm here with Brett Stevens. Today we have a guest on our show. Her name is Carolyn Emmerich. She is a professional folklorist. She has a magazine called Europa Sun. She is becoming an interesting figure in right-wing politics and in nationalism today. She talks a lot about European culture, European religion, things like that. And we're really happy to have her here on Nationalist Public Radio. So Carolyn, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for having me. I'm happy to be here.
Before we get to the questions, just tell us a little bit about yourself and your background and where we can find you online.
All right. Well, I've been writing about European history and cultures since about 2012. But I mean, it's been really a lifelong passion for me. It's the kind of thing where when I went to college, I didn't know what to study other than European history and culture. So I bounced around a little bit between history major, English major. I was briefly a medieval studies major. But every time I was studying European history, was my passion. So I think that dabbling in those different things kind of set me up for what I'm doing now. And then I ended up discovering a Celtic-themed magazine back in 2012. It was called Celtic Guide, but the editor is no longer happy with my political persuasion, so we're no longer affiliated. But that was almost like an apprenticeship for me because I was so excited to find this cultural magazine. I have strong British heritage, so when I found this indie mag that he was just giving away for free, I jumped right in. It was brand new at that time, and I volunteered to help out. Pretty soon, I started writing for him. I started recruiting writers for him. So that turned into a really big apprenticeship for me for the whole cultural magazine sphere. That's kind of how I got into it. And then things changed for me when the migrant crisis happened, and I became more concerned with the threats to our culture and became more vocal about that, and all hell sort of broke loose because I was in the cultural sphere, the folklore sphere, which is very academic, and we know who, you know, runs our academia today. And it was also heavily in the pagan community, which there are like two factions of pagan community. There's the far right or right wing. Usually they're Germanic heathen pagans, and then there's like the foofy La La Land Wiccan pagans and California pagans, and a lot of those people were following my work because folklore appeals to them, and they just lost their minds when I started standing up for Western culture. So that turned my whole world upside down for a good long time, and that's how I found the alt-right, kind of by accident. So here I am.
And we're happy to have you. I really enjoyed your Europa Sun that you let me read. I'm really happy about that. So you mentioned paganism and the neo-pagan movement, and there's a lot of talk about the role of religion in the alt-right and in the far-right. And some people decry it as necessarily secular, or some people say that, you know, Christianity is terribly cucked and is unsalvageable, but then there are other people who say, okay, well, Christianity is kind of an ethnic religion. It's basically a white religion. Some people would argue that. But how do you view the pagan and neo-pagan movement and the relationship to the alt-right?
Paganism and the nationalist movement can be compared to Christianity and the nationalist movement because you've got a lot of Christians who are really right-wing, they're really aware of what's going on, and they see and I don't agree with this at all, but they see Christianity as European identity. And I'm not going to say it's not European identity, but I just don't think it's the definitive European identity. And it's also the identity of lots of non-Europeans in the world, too. So that's just why I make the distinction there. I mean, you've got this break in the pagan culture, just like you've got the break in the Christian culture, where you've got your left-wing pagans, you've got your left-wing Christians, you've got the left-wing Pope now encouraging multiculturalism and encouraging the flooding of Europe with non-white people. So you've got, I guess, both camps and both sides.
Some people have argued that paganism is not necessarily something that is going to allow for a spiritual resurgence in Europeans. People have said specifically that Western culture and Western civilization is Christian culture and Christian civilization. And yet we know that Christianity is, in a way, a kind of a vessel for pre-Christian Europe, for the Celtic, Germanic, Roman, and Greco-pagan religions. When we say the Greco-Roman legacy, we're essentially saying a pagan legacy. Do you think that it's possible that we could have a kind of perhaps techno-pagan, maybe is the word for it, resurgence, where we are essentially looking to nature for spirituality, but embracing the essential nature of the modern world of the 21st century? Because I would say that the Germanic people would have embraced technology in the same way that the Nordic people embraced the technologies of their time that allowed them to conquer the oceans. I would look at the internet in the same way. I would say that perhaps there is maybe a soul of a new machine, to use the old death metal reference, to the pagan movement. Do you think that maybe there's a spiritual connection that people on the right need right now?
100%. And this gets really complicated, and I could talk at length on this, so it's hard to make it succinct. I've been having really good conversations at length on this on a podcast I just started on YouTube called Voklore with a V. I urge people to listen to that if you have time to really get in depth on it. I hate to say we didn't have the chance to the spirituality with the culture, because what I'm arguing these days is very strongly asserting that paganism didn't actually die out. It did survive very strongly in our folk tradition, which is evidenced in our folklore, our fairy tales, especially the agricultural traditions. There are actually what you would define as rituals or practices that carried on in Europe. They still happen today, everywhere from Great Britain, all the way to Germany, all the way to Russia, even in Italy, not with great frequency anymore, but it's in the rural agricultural communities where they'll do these practices that have pagan connotations, and they still have very strong pagan connotations. So there's a lot of ways where the ancient faith actually carried on in a living tradition. We've just been told that it's dead. So people are almost like trained not to see what's right in front of them. But that said, it obviously couldn't survive in an open, overt way. And there are certain parts of it that couldn't survive. So had it been allowed to continue unmolested openly, it absolutely would have evolved. It would have accepted technology. Pagans were just like anyone else. They used what made their life easier. The important part about what you're saying about Europeans needing a new faith revival is that, I mean, Christianity is universalist in the same way that Islam is, and anybody can be a Christian. We've got in America, the people who are flooding America aren't really the Muslims. We're not getting that in America. Europe's getting that. In America, we're getting Central and South Americans, and they're bringing Catholicism with their Christians. There are probably more devout Christians coming from Central and South America into the United States than there are really devout Catholics, white Catholics in the United States. I mean, because these people take their religion very seriously. But when it comes to paganism, the important thing that I think Christians need to understand is that this is a faith that is intrinsically rooted in our culture. So I feel very strongly that if someone is ethnic European and Christianity does it for you, that's great. By all means, embrace that. I'm happy for you. But if they turn it around and try to mock or disparage paganism, the problem is that paganism is rooted in our cultural origins. It's our indigenous past. So disparaging European paganism is actually disparaging our own culture. And if we're in a position where our culture is completely at risk, why would you have a problem with someone embracing a faith that is tied to their culture? Like, my faith and my culture are one and the same. It makes me double down on my cultural heritage. It makes my cultural heritage that much more important to me. So I think that a faith that celebrates our cultural heritage in such a strong way is crucial.
It's very interesting that you dig into it that way, because when we look at modern religion, it's all universalist because it's framed as a religion. But in my understanding, the ancients understood their religion only as their customs. That is, their religious practice was entirely tied to their tribe, and it wasn't something that they saw as religion. It was just another way of understanding the world. My question is twofold. First, do you see the difference between Christianity and paganism as one that is tied up with the dichotomy between universalism and esotericism? And second, can you tell us what paganism is? because I think you'll have an expert level definition that for a lot of people who are unfamiliar with this and anything but sort of New Age Wiccanism, that would be very helpful.
This actually came up. I had a chat with a Hindu friend and another good friend of mine just the other night, and we were discussing Arianism and the difference between Arianism and Universalism. We were talking about what Arianism means to us, the Indo-European connection, because obviously the Aryans were the Indo-Europeans who seeded cultures in Europe and in India and elsewhere. So Hindus today have an ancient cultural tie to Europeans. So we were exploring that. And the difference is now I can recognize that my Hindu friend has a mythos that is similar to Europeans' mythos, but it's also going to be inherently different. So by respecting his belief and recognizing that origin, I'm in no way saying that we are one and the same or that we even practice the same religion. We're not universalist, because when you practice a native faith that is intrinsically tied to your culture, it leaves room for the local, the regional. And this is crucial right now, because when you're looking at the European Union and you're looking at globalism, and I did an article, and it's also a video on YouTube, about the hundreds of European languages are facing extinction right now. And why is that? Because we've got freedom of movement, we've got people moving every which way, we've got mass immigration, and so the local and the regional, which is the native diversity of Europe, which European diversity, is being killed because of the universalism that's going to be caused from globalism, immigration. Religion is the same way. The second you join a universalist religion is the second you're turning your back on your indigenous culture. All the practices that your ancestors did, I mean, unless you're able to carry them on in encoded ways or somewhat muted ways, which Europeans did a lot better than Islamists did. When your faith makes room for variation, cultural variation, such as European paganism, because European paganism is not monolithic, there will be threads of continuity, connecting, and familiarity, similarities that you'll see from Britain all the way across to Russia. Then you will zoom in and you'll see differences. And that's that rich tapestry of European culture, where we're all related as Europeans. We're all different by our language group, by our local culture group. So I think having a faith that not only respects that, but revels in it and celebrates it and keeps it alive. Honestly, I can't think of what European culture needs more right now than that.
Let me expand on that a little bit. Whenever I look at the sort of traditional European folk stories and epic poems, things like Homer, the foundational stories of Europe, the sagas and whatnot, I see heroism. And that's something that Brett and I have talked about on other podcasts, and something that we've talked about on this podcast is the need for heroism in the West right now. How do you see the role of folklore and of also the role of honoring our ancestors through this paganist movement, the Astru movement, as a possible way to revitalize the spirit of heroism? And as a second correlation to that, I would like to ask you, how do you view the question of, maybe the best way to put it is to say, Julian, whenever he was attempting to revive paganism, he ran into a number of problems, the biggest one of which seemed to be that people liked the hope that Christianity offered, more so than the connection to their own ancestors. How do you view the relationship between hope and paganism that people may need? Is there hope in paganism?
Well, I'll start with the heroism thing. It's funny that you bring that up, because, well, there's a lot of synchronicity going on right now. So that's another spiritualist topic that a lot of rationalists probably would scoff at. But there's definitely something that collectively we're tapping into, and that's also driving this movement. So it's kind of uncanny that you mentioned the hero and ancestor worship thing, because that came into my head a couple weeks ago just out of the blue, and I actually was buying books on these things. So whatever I say now, I'm probably going to develop further, because that was a research project I had planned for an article for Europa Sun. It just came into my head that heroism, especially right now when we've got a culture that's tearing down the heroes of the West, and this is where history and myth and legend can overlap, because Well, there is a relationship between history and mythology and legend. Some people believe some of the gods originated as chieftains who were great warriors and great heroes and drifted into legend. And one thing that I have discussed is Arthur versus Charlemagne, for example. We know Charlemagne existed. It's heavily documented. You can't really try to deny that he existed because there's so much evidence for it. But Arthur, there's not as much evidence that he existed. So it's a lot of speculation. All we have is the myths and the legends. But now if you go back to the Middle Ages, something I learned when I was briefly a medieval studies student is that the same phenomenon of warrior, king, hero drifting into myth and legend actually started happening during Charlemagne's time and briefly after. Legends were told about him that were not true at all. Like, his reputation became so big in the consciousness of the people that they started making up legends and singing songs and myths. He started drifting into legendary status. So that's proof that we know that this happens with historical figures. When we see our current historical figures being attacked, and the relationship between myth and history, and this is where I think that myth shouldn't be discounted as silly or unimportant, because there is a relationship there, and our historical heroes should reach mythic status in our consciousness, because that's hugely important for our psyches as individuals and as a culture. The fact that we have heroes in our myths, they're not any less important than the heroes in our history. And when we see our heroes in history being attacked right now, there are statues being ripped down, the history being basically mistold with agenda-driven spin on it. And this is something I'm trying to do in Europa Sun, because this is happening, I've been pulled away from the folklore, which is my passion, in order to address more mundane history, which is a little bit more boring for me, but I feel like it has to be done because we can't let them do this to us. So in issue 2, I talked about Dr. Livingston. Now, most of us remember as from being kids, Dr. Livingston was even on Sesame Street. He was famous. Everybody knew Dr. Livingston, I presume. Everybody knew that. You talk to millennials today, they've never heard of the guy. My brother's 8 years younger than me. I'm in my mid-30s. He's in his late 20s. He never heard of the guy. It's like, what is going on with our heroes just disappearing from history? And it does tie into ancestor veneration, because the reason that certain chieftains would be honored is because they were considered ancestors of the entire tribe. So we were a culture that venerated our ancestors. We venerated our great leaders, our heroes, our warriors, side by side with the gods. And I think that if we did that today, this came up in the Aryan chat I just had with my Hindu friend. He told us that he wakes up every day and the first thing he does is he honors the gods and he honors his ancestors. Now, I don't think any Christian will tell you the first thing they do is wake up and honor their God and their ancestors. If we were honoring our ancestors as part of our tradition and our practice in a spiritual way, I don't think we'd be in this mess at all right now.
Do you think that if we were to look at our heroes again and say, okay, this is who I could be, is it possible that we would be able to derive values, perhaps Faustian values is the best way to call them, to name them, that we would be able to use that as a stepping point to revitalize the West? Because it seems to me that, you know, people are not going to fight for a culture that is based in fish and chips and Doctor Who episodes. You mentioned Livingstone. He was a fascinating character, an interesting man, and it's quite a shame that people don't understand that that is the legacy of Britain more than Neil Gaiman novels.
Absolutely. One of the things that I had in mind for this topic was there had been a psychological study that had come out recently on the ancestor effect and how it affects a child psychologically, how they think about their ancestors. And this was published in scholarly journals. So, I mean, this is legit research here. If you think positively about your ancestors, it has a psychological effect on you, your self-esteem, your achievement in life. If this is true, now think about all the little white children in the world, in the West right now, who are being told that their ancestors were jerks and they were the demon of the world. The white man is, when we know that this is not true, if you've studied history, you absolutely know that they're full of crap. Like, everybody did bad things in history, everybody did good things in history, and the Western civilization was a leader in a lot of issues that liberals claim that are important these days. When we're being told as a culture that our ancestors are evil and to be ashamed of them, this is going to affect so many people on an individual level that it's going to affect us on a societal and cultural level as well. So venerating our cultural ancestors and heroes. So you've got your direct family ancestors, but the heroes, they are our collective ancestors of our tribe, of our society. So it makes a big difference. And that is something that I'm trying to do. I'm making an effort to do that in Europa Sun, is to remember these figures, because they are profoundly important on our society, how we view ourselves. And they're really important to pass on to our children.
I was just going to add in really quickly that we can tell ancestors are important because we see the devastating effect that divorce has on children. When a divorce happens, it's effectively saying that one or both of your parents are somehow out of place or bad or don't belong, and a lot of parents talk bad about the other parent or otherwise slander them in such a way that makes that child doubt their conception and their heritage. And that really creates people who are adrift. They have no anchor to something greater in history and the past and through that into the future. There's no continuity between 1,000 years ago and 10,000 years from now. So you're sort of stranded in this, what video game do I want to play? What movie do I want to watch? And what kind of beer am I going to drink? I think you're onto something there with the ancestor effect.
What you just said could be extrapolated into so many different ways. This is why if you come from a racially diverse family, there's a lot of confusion there too, because you don't exactly have that tie to ancestry, because your ancestry is very fractured and you don't really know where you fit, where you belong. And then just to go back to something that was mentioned in the beginning of the conversation of, is this a symptom of no longer having Christianity? It was recorded in the Roman observations, I think it was Tacitus who observed the Germanic tribes, and he noted that they were known for their chastity, not meaning like they lived like monks and nuns, but meaning that they were not promiscuous. They were monogamous, and the men and the women were faithful to their partner. So European culture has a very strong history of placing the family, and the monogamous family unit is an integral part of our culture going back well before we were Christians. And so then if you think about it in those terms, that we have been monogamous with a strong family unit culture for so long, and now all of the sudden it's just all fallen apart. It's like, no wonder our culture is in shambles, because this is affecting our collective psyche and people are damaged from it. So I think that making that effort to reconnect to culture in any way, if it's like, if you don't find paganism interesting, you can't wrap your head around it, that's fine. But connect to culture, make your ethnicity and these institutions that were once dear to us a priority, and heroes, absolutely.
You trained in history. Let me ask you a little bit about the historian Thomas Carlyle and his great man theory of history, which is something I'm very interested in right now. He formulated the concept that history is essentially moved by great men, the Caesars, the Napoleons, Dante, Shakespeare, et cetera, et cetera. The counter argument to that, though, was that these men were products of their society and that without them, there would have been no great man in the first place. The rejection of Carlyle and the rejection of his great man theory of history, while not necessarily itself inherently a problem, was in a way a rejection of historical European understanding of heroism, because Carlyle was a man responding to the French Revolution and to the Enlightenment. He was a man who existed in the Industrial Revolution, but he himself was not a materialist. He understood that there was a spiritual value to heroism. His quote was that great men should rule and that others should revere them. And that was, in a way, his summary of the understanding of heroic spirits. He was responding to the Enlightenment, he was responding to the French Revolution, and to egalitarianism, and he simply said that life is best under aristocracy, and that, you know, great men should rule and other people should simply accept it and acknowledge that there is a relationship between the aristocracy and the monarchy, and the regular people. He was, in a way, just expanding on the notion that there is a relationship between monarch and subject, in the same way that there's a relationship between father and son, that it's not an abusive or horrible relationship. It's simply a relationship based on love and mutual respect, and that is essentially what monarchy and aristocracy can be. But he also expanded it to literary figures, to historical figures. He included Muhammad, I think, in one of them as well, which is something I'd take issue with. But, you know, I'd like to know, how do you view the disconnect between heroism pre-Industrial Revolution, pre-French Revolution, and the situation that we're in today with the absolute lack of heroes?
Today, we don't have great leaders anymore by the nature of the system under which we're operating. So it's like when you have democracy, you've got career politicians, and they don't really do anything great for us. It's not like they're out on the battlefield winning wars. And when you have an ethno-monarchy, the monarch is duty-bound to his people. And the way that nobility works is that if the monarch is a tyrant, if you've just pissed off all your nobles, and your nobles have their own army, and they can come and throw over the monarch. So that's a way to keep it in check. But the nobles, they have their own people locally to them. And if they're not treating their people right, you can rise up. You can deal with it. We can't do that anymore. You can't rise up against a tyrannical government in the United States, because what's going to happen? There's going to be tanks on the street. So there's really nothing for us to do except sit here and be frustrated. Voting, we've seen, doesn't really do very much. Not that I'm saying people shouldn't vote, or not that I'm saying that recent elections haven't been significant, because they have been, and I'm not being a nihilist. I don't think that we're in a situation where we have no recourse or things are never going to improve. But yeah, it definitely goes hand in hand. If we don't have someone to look up to who we believe has our best interest in mind, or if these people are beholden to shadowy global donors who are funding them, I mean, it definitely is going to have a trickle-down effect on society and the individual feeling that you can actually, that you have some sort of role in your society, that, or that society is even coherent as a group. Like, we're just very fractured and disconnected from the whole process.
What are traditional European religion and culture?
This is a tricky one, because it goes back to the Christianity versus paganism thing. And I think it's important to note that history has always been recorded by people with an agenda, always, and it always has been throughout the Middle Ages up until now. So when we read history that speaks of Christendom, well, Christendom was initially, it was a political movement. Monarchs converted for political reasons to create alliances. So it was a top-down ideological shift. And who was writing the history? It was monarch-sponsored, or it was coming from the monasteries. So most people will argue that Christianity is traditional European religion. So, I mean, you can't really discount that. It was present in Europe all this time, and it's in the history. But if you look to the practices of the people, the folklore, their tradition, the folk history, what emerges is a very different picture. And when you look into the beliefs of the people and what they thought, what they were doing, what you end up seeing in the Slavic tradition, they actually do refer to it as the dual faith. And I think it's a little disappointing that Western Europeans look to Slavic Europe and they acknowledge this dual faith, but they fail to see that it actually happened in Western Europe too. It happened very strongly in Britain and especially Scandinavia and everywhere. So, I mean, I think traditional, to me, it's more complex than religion, because it's also, it's the folk beliefs that people might not even think of as religion today. Like, I talk about in my work how these beliefs lived on in the spiritual roots that we don't always understand, like the spiritual roots of some of our Christmas traditions that are actually rooted in European native faith. People see it, they enact it, they continue to tell these stories or continue the practices without quite really understanding. But those practices and those traditions are still part of our native faith, living on, almost in our collective unconscious. So I almost look at this as in a Jungian view, where Christianity was our conscious. That's what we were aware of, because that's what the messaging has been. This is another thing that people don't get. I mean, in the right wing, they'll see that we're subjected to messaging today, and that the messaging is coming through the TV, it's coming through movies, it's coming through music. That's leading our culture down a path. That's leading our young people to believe certain things. But they don't really see that when Europe was Christianized, the pulpit was your television. I mean, you didn't go to the movies. You didn't have a radio. What did you do? Once a week you went, or more than once a week in some cases, and that was your messaging. On a conscious level, especially if you could be burned at the stake or called a heretic and killed or dunked in the lake for professing to believe something different. Of course, consciously, you're going to profess what you're told to profess, but unconsciously, all of these things were kept alive. So, it's not realistic to tell every European, if you want to be a traditionalist, you better go and accept paganism. And there's a whole lot of people out there who are going to vehemently disagree with that, and they're going to say, well, Catholicism is my traditionalism, or Orthodoxy is my... That's fine. I think the real meat of it is that if you're keeping your European traditions alive, that's the root of it. And if you're doing that in a Christian context or you're doing that in a pagan context, it doesn't really matter, so long as you're rooted in that traditional European mindset and you're making that a conscious focus of your life, if that makes sense.
I was struck by how much it seemed that paganism has crept back into Christianity and how much it's always been there. When you read the Greeks or the Eddas or some of the older material that's been floating around from Germany, you start to realize how much the mythos in Christianity has been, I don't want to say borrowed, but alluded to, let's say that. It's taken from the pagan ideas, it's just been written down, and that's that esoteric versus universalist idea. The esoteric idea is that you do not have a universal truth, you have sort of little seeds. And if people pursue them, they're able to understand them to the best of their ability, which is somewhat unequal. And some will really pursue them further and get a lot of truth out of them, and others will just want to hover at the surface and pay attention to what they can handle, which generally is what has utility in their lives. Things like be honest, don't steal, chastity, fidelity to your faith, to a belief in, I don't want to say the supernatural, but to something more than the material. With that, you can see the pagan roots sort of bleeding through. And I was going to ask real quick before I got on to our next scheduled question, what do you think is the future of Christianity, and do you see it possibly becoming more pagan as this folklore takes precedent over those more universalist beliefs that were kind of always more political, or should we say more motivational toward mass culture? Do you think that there's a change afoot in Christianity today?
This is another one that could just go on and on forever, because, first of all, people who think that Christianity has been this monolithic thing and it's always been the same, and European Christianity is, I mean, that's just preposterous, because Christianity has always evolved. From the very beginning, I mean, Paul of Tarsus, who was Saul of Tarsus before he took his new name, he had conflict with the original followers of Jesus who were, I've done a lot of reading into the origins of Christianity too, and also I wrote an article on the origins of Hebrew faith in my old magazine, Mythology Magazine. And so this has just always been a process. People have no idea the pagan roots that they're dealing with. Now, if you go to the Old Testament, Christians really ought to look into the origins of this, because this is where the religion comes from. But Yahweh was a pagan god of the Canaanites. He was the son of the god called El. He was like the daddy sky god of the Canaanites. I've actually listened to a lot of Jewish scholars who are Jewish biblical scholars, and they will tell you that one strong theory is that the Hebrews were simply Canaanites who just sort of changed their ideology, and then that became the dominant ideology. But the word El became the Hebrew word for God. And even though Yahweh ended up taking over and becoming the main God, the word El is still seen all over the Hebrew language, like in names that we have today, like Michael, Rachel, the El. Those are Hebrew names that have the Hebrew word for God, El. Or the term El Shaddai means God of the mountain, because El was originally worshipped on a mountain. So the very origins of Hebrew faith were in Canaanite polytheism. They ended up elevating first El and then Yahweh. Now we've got this Jewish religion, or they weren't called Jews at that time, but you've got the Hebrew religion, and then here comes this Jesus guy. But when he was killed, now people also don't remember that this happened in the context of the lead up to the Jewish revolt. I believe that was 67 AD or 70 AD, something like that. So this is like a contentious time in Israeli, which was Palestine at that time, versus Rome. So you've got this guy who's got this movement, he's killed. It was his brother who took over. And you would think if there was one person who knew what his brother was about, it would be the guy who grew up with him and was side by side with him throughout his entire life's mission. He was the one who took over the original Christian church. Along comes Paul of Tarsus, who never met Jesus, not even once, has this weird hallucination on the road to wherever he was going, and says, well, Jesus came to me as a spirit, and I have the true message of Jesus now. There was a big conflict with James and the original followers. Now, if you go to the book of James in the Bible today, it's still in the New Testament, the book of James is accredited to the brother of Jesus, and there is no mention of Jesus as divinity anywhere in that book. Okay, now, there was a version of Christianity called Arianism, not related to Arians, meaning what you think of like Indo-Europeans, but it was named after the guy who founded it. His name had Arian in it.
Arius,
yeah. They did not recognize the divinity of Jesus. And they were, I believe, that was the version practiced by the Goths initially. There's just all these variations. I mean, now something that I just discovered that blew my freaking mind, because I get into etymology and all of that, was I knew the etymology of the word Lord from the Anglo-Saxon, and it comes from the Anglo-Saxon that means loaf ward, meaning the guardian of the grain, right? And you can verify this. You can go on the internet and look up etymology of Lord. It's Germanic origin. So I'm sitting here thinking, well, why would we be using a Germanic origin word that means guardian of the grain for Jesus Christ as Lord? That doesn't really make sense to me. So I started thinking, when did this come into play? It's not a literal translation. In the Greek, it's kurios or something like that, but it means like master, but it doesn't have that origin, grain, guardian. Now, in the Germanic tradition, the god Frey is also called Ing, and his name means Lord, loaf ward, guardian of the grain. He was an agricultural deity, and his sister was Freya, which meant lady, lord and lady. So I started trying to figure out when the word Lord entered Christianity. It entered it the first ever Bible translation into a Germanic language, which was to evangelize the early medieval Germanics. So whoever was translating that, his name was like Wolfius or Wolfinus, something like that. But he used that word specifically. It wasn't just a whoopsies. He chose that word in order to bring the Goths around and Germanite, because they were already praying to the Lord. That was already part of their religion. Lord was their name for their own God. Suddenly, here comes Christianity. We're going to use this word. I mean, it wouldn't have been in the Hebrew. It wouldn't have been in Aramaic, which Jesus' followers spoke. And it wouldn't have been in the Greek. This is a Germanic word. So then this is really mind-blowing. Then you think about it. Every single Christian who is praying to the Lord, they're praying to Frey, the Germanic God. That was his name. It was not the name of the Hebrew God. The Hebrew God was El and then Yahweh. And Jesus's followers called him teacher. They didn't call him guardian of the grain. You know what I mean? Like, so this idea, and this is again the Jungian conscious versus the unconscious. On a societal level, our conscious has been telling us we're Christianity, but our unconscious has been praying to the Germanic God Frey. If you're practicing Christianity speaking the English language. I mean, I don't know, that blows my mind. So the paganism in Christianity is and has always been there. And will it evolve as we go forward? I don't know that it would necessarily become more pagan, but it's obviously become liberal. And there's not one Christianity. There's tons of different factions of Christianity today, just like there always have been. So it's hard to say what direction Christianity will go in, because one will probably go this way, another one will probably go that way. And I mean, it's a toss-up, really.
One of the things I was interested in, and recently I got into a discussion with someone on the nature of the origin of culture, and this is a friend of mine who is a devout Catholic, and he insisted that culture comes from religion. I insisted that culture comes from ethnicity and the stories of your folk, essentially. And he made the point that people, or for example, Renaissance Christians repainted Jesus not as a Semite, but as a white European due to anti-Semitism. I made the point that no, people make their gods in their image. And he said that that I was essentially arguing, if that was the case, that the Catholic Church is not Catholic. And he and I have gone round and round on this several times. And it occurred to me that the ultimate refutation of that is that religion itself also comes from ethnicity. And if you doubt that, you could look at the fact that Gautama Buddha is an ethnic Indian who is almost invariably portrayed as an East Asian. And that's because he is almost universally honored and revered in East Asia. And it seems to me that that's simply the case of the way Europeans have reinvented Jesus as a European, not as a Semite. And I would like to ask you what your view on the relationship between ethnicity and religion is, and is religion necessarily ethnic? The correlate to that would be, why do you think the doctrines of Jesus took off in Europe after the 4th century and Mithras fell? Because Mithras and Jesus are often compared.
I think religion is absolutely bound to ethnicity, or at least it should be. I think it's not anymore, and that's part of the problem. Is regarding Jesus being portrayed as blonde-haired, blue-eyed, Aryan, European, everybody did that. You can go back to, I mean, Ethiopians were Christians very early on, before most of Europe was still pagan. There were Egyptian Coptic Christians, there were Ethiopian Christian communities, and they depicted Jesus as black, or like themselves. So I've seen liberals try to make that argument that that's just another example of European racism, but all it's an example of is their own ignorance. Christianity has always been adapted to suit the culture that was adopting it, and it's always evolved as the culture has evolved. But in terms of ethnicity and faith, the fact of the situation is that humanity always had this sort of holistic whole that was your ethnicity, your language, your mythos, your tribe, your identity was all one. It was a whole. Now, along comes these Abrahamic universalist religions. All of a sudden, your faith is taken out of your identity. And we see this today, and this is what really irks me in the white nationalist movement, is you've got these Christians claiming to be white nationalists or claiming to be ethno-nationalists, but they'll still tell you, I'm a Christian first. I'm a Christian first and foremost. And it's like, well, you know what? There are Ethiopians that will say that. There are Mexicans that will say that. There are blacks in America who will say that. And ethnicity should be bound with your faith, because, I mean, that's just always how it was. Through the evolution of humanity and through the evolution of these cultures that we come from, we always were a unified whole. And I do think this affects you on a psychological level. And once you start fracturing that, it's like chipping away at your identity. And before you know it, you're in the situation we're in now. And I don't think that it has to do with leaving Christianity. If you want to actually get down to the origins of the problem, I would say that Christianity eroding our sense of self is probably where it started.
It seems to me that as I've been investigating European paganism, and I've been reading things like McNallan, and then I'm now on to things like Pedrick Colum and Helene Gruber and things like that, and just as an investigation of heroism and the nature of the European soul, how do you view those pagans who say that European paganism is universal? Is that not simply a remnant of Christianity that they are hanging on to? And is that not sort of a betrayal of the very nature of ethnic religion? And as a corollary to that, is it not also racist itself for those people to say, yes, Africans and Asians should honor our ancestors more than their own? Because they seem to make the argument that if you are excluding non-Europeans from European paganism, that you are, in fact, the racist, where it seems to me that the racist argument would be our ancestors are worthy of you honoring them.
When I first came to paganism, the first group I found was the Universalist. And I was raised very conservative evangelical, and then I moved into more, especially being in a blue state, going to college, all my friends were liberal. I was running in more left-wing circles, as most of us do in your early 20s or whatever. So the first pagan group I found was, they're called the Troth or the Troth, and they're very Universalist. So I was exposed to all of that way of thinking. And the way that they describe it is the gods will call who they call, and if you are called by a god, then you're called by that god. It is what it is. But my thinking now, as I've really evolved and I've been reading and investigating and diving deep and thinking, is the reason that I feel that you should stick to your ancestral path is a theory I've been developing that I have no way of proving whatsoever, but it just makes sense to me in my mind, is that because I'm not a linguist, I'm not an etymologist, but I get interested, I'm curious. So I'll like the Lord etymology and the at El, you know, El Shaddai, all that. I just want to know where these words came from, why we say things. What I've learned is that our language evolved with our mythos in ways that, again, it's conscious versus unconscious. We're not aware of it today. And maybe this goes back to, I had a really good English teacher in high school who taught us, we were reading Shakespeare's Macbeth, and he taught us the word, when they said the three weird sisters, the word weird today, it means awkward or whatever, but it used to mean spiritual. And then before that, it comes from the word, W-Y-R-D, which was the Anglo-Saxon concept of fate. And the reason that the three weird sisters show up in Macbeth is because it's a remembrance of the Norns, the three women who have to do with your fate. And I talk about this in my fairy tale series, and this particular example comes up through the whole series, but that's the subject of the first book. So I've just started developing this theory that, you know, if we had a psychological, cultural, spiritual wholeness at one point, and our language evolved with our mythos, and you can actually learn about our mythos through words that we're still using today, like weird, like Lord, like the days of the week, other things that we just don't even know. And then I read the news, and another science article, a hot topic in the science world, had been inherited memories and epigenetics and how you can inherit memories from your ancestors. So I started thinking that, you know, your culture, your mythos, and your language probably has an imprint on you psychologically and neurologically. And even though language evolves, you know, it's a slow process, and you're probably inheriting an imprint from every single ancestor that came before you back to your origins, which affects you on a subconscious psychological level that you can't really understand, which is also why I think this fracturing is really damaging to us individually and society, because we've been pulled away from this sense of wholeness that I believe is imprinted on us psychologically. So I think that all of this comes together in such a deep way, and our language, our mythos is in us. So if you are just going to randomly adopt some other god or some other religion, you're not going to have that connection to it. You're not going to have this intuitive nature to it. I do think that our gods and our ancestors are part of us, and that's evidenced by how it does linger on in our language. Once you start to unravel that, it's almost like a secret that nobody knows. You just need the key once you start unraveling that. And once you do start unraveling that, you start to see things in our folk tradition that we've been trained not to see, or we forgot that we're there. And that's what I do in my fairy tale series, is I start unlocking this. Then you can start to see how this unconscious understanding really, it was a living tradition. It didn't die. We have not been Christian for 2,000 years. We've not been without our pagan folk soul for 2,000 years once you start to know how to see it. So, yeah, I do think it's intrinsically bound up. Religion and ethnicity are bound up, I think, in a way that people can't even really grasp because it's so deep.
And you mentioned that you have a channel on YouTube as well. I'm wondering, why do you choose to go with print publications of Europa Sun rather than focusing on YouTube or something like that? Do you have a background in publishing? And how much work goes into publishing a copy of Europa Sun?
I don't have a background in publishing, but I've always been good at sort of academic writing since I was younger. I mean, I was in honors English classes, and in high school and in college, professors always wanted to use my research papers or my college papers as examples for the other students. I ended up with a degree in literature, but I did take history, and I took it historiography at the graduate level too, so I understand history, even though my degree ended up being in literature, but I just did so much writing for that, I ended up becoming really comfortable with that. It just comes naturally to me. I didn't really even want to be on YouTube. Everyone just kept telling me that I should. So I started making movies, but I'm making them off of my articles for the most part, except for the new podcast, which is what I do with other people, like what we're doing right now, talking about the things that I've read and researched. And I don't think I would be really able to make really good YouTube videos if I didn't have this sort of research writing background, because when I write an article, I do a lot of research for it, I take notes, and depending on what I'm writing about, sometimes it has to percolate in my mind for a long time, like with the fairy tale series. It's not just a report where I'm reading facts and then regurgitating them back to you. Some of them I takes a lot of thought process to connect the dots on my end and come up with a theory or what I'm trying to present. For me, the YouTube is just a way to introduce people to what I'm writing about, because the writing, you can get a lot more in-depth, and then it's hard to put an in-depth article on YouTube, basically. So I don't have a talent of just turning on a camera and talking at it. Some people are really good at that. Stefan Molyneux, he's really good at that. That's not my talent. My talent is I'm going to look, and I wouldn't be able to sit here and have the conversation with you that we've been having if I wasn't doing all the research and the writing, you know what I mean? Like, that's what's informing me. So that's what I'm running on, basically.
Like the pagans, you get into this frame of mind where everything is united. All different types of learning sort of converge. And I think that's something that lit majors often have, because you do study history and a little bit of science and a little bit of philosophy, and you sort of knit it all together. Because otherwise the literature is sort of without a context and it can set you off. But I was going to ask, speaking of threading together different ideas and domains of ideas, how do you view yourself and what you do relative to nationalist movements? Are you a purely cultural entity, or do you see this as sort of a convergent philosophy where when you go down one path, it leads to another and another? You know, all roads lead to Rome. How do you feel about that?
Well, for me, I guess I started out as a purely cultural entity. Well, I guess when he asked if I had a background in publishing, just with that Celtic magazine that I had talked about, and I was doing that for 5 years, just purely volunteer. And I mean, I had already spent my whole life being interested in this and studying these kind of things in college, but then I had really dove into that Celtic magazine, which got me. Because I had to come up with something every month to fit the theme, and the theme was related to British culture. So I started researching, and it ended up becoming folklore. So I got into the folklore. But even back then, it's funny when I look back at those articles, there's a bunch of articles before I took the proverbial red pill, where even then I was telling people our culture needs to be protected. And we have a society now that tells us to be tolerant or to respect all these other cultures, but maybe it's time that we stop fetishizing other cultures and we remember our own culture, because our culture is, just by studying the folk tradition itself before the migrant crisis, before all this, I mean, I could see that folklore, folk tradition is an example of how different things, before even globalism, it was industrialization and it was the movement of people from the rural areas into the city, which caused an erosion of folk culture and all of that. And, you know, materialism and capitalism in the sense of we work ourselves to the bone and we don't put a lot of stock in our traditions anymore. And I was becoming aware of all those things through the folklore study before moving into nationalism. And I was already urging people of the need to reconnect and do this. And then the migrant crisis happened and this coincided with Black Lives Matter. And then the raising of the vitriol from the left with Whitey, kill Whitey. At the time, my ex-boyfriend, he was taking college classes and he had a black professor who brought a guest in over Skype, another black guy. The black guy signed off with kill Whitey as his, in, you know, some people say peace out. He said kill Whitey as his sign off. My ex-boyfriend's telling me about this and I'm like, and nobody reported this guy? Nobody called him out on it? No. And people are getting fired from their jobs for so much less. So this is all happening and this is pissing me off because I'm somebody who's been rooted in my culture my whole life. All my friends were lefty. My ex-boyfriend was lefty. Everybody I knew was lefty. But I guess out of all of them, I was so grounded in my cultural heritage that I'm getting really pissed off now because they're attacking us. They're attacking us as an ethnic group. They're attacking our society. They're invading our lands. We're becoming minorities in our lands and nobody cares. So this is like, you know, where I just lose it. And I took to my own private Facebook and I was going off about it. And, you know, so this is where I moved into nationalism because if you love something, you have to protect it. And so this is where I started butting heads with all these other folklorists because here they are, they're studying the traditions of their culture, but they won't stand up and fight for it. So that pisses me off because it's like, where do you get off? Like pretending that you love this culture, but you're happy to just see it washed away? I mean, there's a disconnect there. I mean, and they came at me for using the term nationalism. Well, it's like through studying folklore, I happen to know the history of folklore. The discipline of it emerged in the original nationalist movement. It was the end of the Romantic era, which was moving into political nationalism, where in the Romantic era, people saw industrialization. In a sense, that was early globalization because that's the late 1800s. Everybody was leaving their countries, moving to the United States to find work, build the railroads, work in factories. That was another globalization push. And the Romantics, they saw this and they said, hang on a second, what is happening to our traditions, to our culture? That's when the first folklorists came on the scene. That's when the Grimm brothers came on the scene. That's when people started traveling around and recording the stories and documenting the practices and talking to the old people who were still alive in the 1700s. If you read folklore accounts in folklore journal from the 1800s, you've got old people telling you stories that their grandparents told them from the 1700s. So we wouldn't have the field of folklore today without nationalism. So to me, I'm just doing exactly what the Grimm brothers did, exactly what the first folklorists did, is saying, wait a second, there's a change happening. We're losing something important, and we need to elevate what we love, protect it, and preserve it. And any folklorist out there who's going to get their panties in a twist over the word nationalism or who doesn't have the guts to stand up and protect it, I mean, they're off base. They shouldn't even be in the field because that's why the field was founded. It was to preserve and protect our own ethnoculture.
You mentioned Jacob Grimm, and he is someone that I'm really interested in, not only because probably the first book I ever owned was a really high-quality copy of Grimm's fairy tales, but because I'm also interested in etymology and in language, what do you think is the relationship between the study of linguistics and etymology and the way we can understand our folklore? And I would also like to follow that up with a question of how do we interpret classical music or what we might broadly call classical music, even though there are differences between romantic music, baroque, classical, whatnot. How do you view the relationship between that and nationalism?
I think I talked about the etymology and folklore connection already also because it was through studying folklore and then getting interested in words where I started to learn how words and the meanings of words turn up in folklore. And if you start to play with etymology and look up words, like for example, in my first fairy tale series, it's called The Three Heads of the Well. And if you didn't know anything about mythology or etymology, in the story, there are these three floating heads in a well that grant wishes. And you would just think, well, that's a weird sort of fantasy fairy tale thing. But the heads actually, when they grant the wishes, they say, I weird to you good fortune. I weird, like using weird as a verb, which would look really weird to people, right? But because, and this was mentioned earlier, the word weird is related to word, W-Y-R-D, the three weird sisters in Shakespeare, the Norns. And this was recorded in the 1900s in England. Even in the 1900s in England, people were still telling these stories where there's these three weird female figures weirding to people as a verb, which means they were directing their fate or their fortune. So if you have an understanding of etymology, you can look at that and you can say, oh, weird. Oh, okay, that doesn't mean weird like I think of it. That means that's directly related to fate, and that's directly related to European native faith. Now, your question about classical music.
Classical music is one of those things that's sort of uniquely European. If one were to try to extract a musical style for the modern world, you're going to have to go back to classical styles in some way or another, in some point or another. I know that there are a lot of people that enjoy fash wave and vaporwave and things because it's reminiscent of the 80s, but classical music seems to be necessarily nationalist. How do you understand the relationship between classical music and ethno-nationalism?
I think it's used by ethno-nationalists because it's so rousing and it's related, especially today, because most people don't really listen to classical music. And so we think of it as your national anthem is probably the classical style song that you hear most often growing up. So there is that association, and anthems are designed to pump you up and get you excited. So that's probably why a lot of nationalists get into that kind of music, because it does. It pumps you up, it gets you excited, and then it puts you... A lot of this is psychological. It puts you in that zone, that psychological zone, to be thinking about your nation. But I mean, I don't really get into that in a nationalistic way. I get into folk music. I've been listening to Celtic Irish folk music a lot lately. And it's funny because my dad's side is German. And on the weekends, he found the only station in the whole area that plays polka music. And if I drop by, I hear him with the polka music going on. And it's just funny. And a lot of people don't really think of that as a big, important thing to culture. But I do think it is, because music has always been part of culture. And they're all little pieces of your cultural identity. The food. I try to make a lot of ethnic-inspired food from my heritage. And it's all part and parcel of your culture. So, I mean, if nationalist classical music does it for people, yeah, I think that's a really good way to rouse you up psychologically. But I also urge people to get into the folk music of their own culture, too.
Do you like bands like Fawn, or I think it's pronounced Culebre, or any of those bands like that, the sort of pagan folk music that's kind of coming out of Germany these days, and I think some of them are also from Spain?
Whenever I hear them, or like Wardruna is a big one that people get excited about, or maybe it's Vardruna, every time I hear them, I always intend to listen to them more, and I don't know why, I just haven't. I've had a Pandora station where I've been playing. I don't know why I think about these things. I think about connections in weird ways. Somehow I got on this Gordon Lightfoot kick, but the thing about him that really is poignant for me, he's Canadian, but some of his music sounds so heavily influenced by Scottish Celtic folk music. Then a lot of the songs you'll find in Canadian folk singers, you'll find this Scotch-Irish heritage, Nova Scotia, you'll find sailor songs that sound like old Irish sailing songs, but they're coming out of Canada. So when I hear this tone or this vibe coming from Gordon Lightfoot, it reminds me, in my mind, the influence of these cultures in the New World. So people wouldn't really think of him as an ethnic singer, but to me he is, because he's the synthesis of the Old World and the New World and the way that those old influences lived on and influenced the culture here. I've been trying to share some of this stuff with this commentary, but it doesn't go over. It goes over like a lead balloon, because people are just kind of like, whatever, that's weird. But I don't know, these are the thoughts that go through my head whenever I think about these things.
But let me ask you, how do you find writers for your magazine? And what do you look for in a writer?
Well, this is also why it took me so long to get this magazine out, because, like I said, I had been so steeped in the folklore community, and then I had that training with that Celtic magazine, so I originally launched Mythology Magazine, and I had a lot of contacts, so it was easy to fill that magazine, because I knew a lot of people who were into this and who were already writing or were interested in writing. Then I went through this big, you know, when you take the red pill or whatever people want to call it, or this parting of ways, turned my whole life upside down. And Mythology Magazine had been launched at the end of 2015, right when the migrant crisis was happening, is when issue one came out. Then issue two came out right when the cologne attacks were happening in December of that year. And then that's when I was just like, oh, screw it, I'm not doing Mythology Magazine anymore, because that was open to all world cultures for mythology. And I was just like, no, I need to double down on Europe. It's nothing against other world cultures. It's just that I need to focus on this right now. But everything changed for me. My whole like social group changed. All my connections, they were gone. So it took me a long time of immersing myself in new circles and meeting people and getting to know people. So there were definitely people I was able to ask if they wanted to contribute. I put out a call for submissions and people responded to it. And I still get messages just from people who found the magazine and they want to contribute. It's not to the point where it fills itself easily yet, because I've only had two issues. So issue one, I wrote 4 articles out of it, and I think I wrote 3 for issue 2. I mean, I want to get to the point where I'm not writing the bulk of it myself, because that feels, I guess, a little like narcissistic to write that much for your own magazine, but you got to fill it. I'd like to write 2 articles just to have more perspectives. But we're getting there. And as it goes out, there was way more interest in this magazine than I ever expected. When I first came into alt-right circles, I had this impression that the alt-right just didn't care about culture, because I had been so immersed in culture before. All I found were alt-right commentators always talking about sociopolitics and current events, which is important. I'm not dissing that. But there was like this dearth for the culture. And my view was like, well, if we don't have the culture, we don't have anything. The sociopolitical commentary is for naught if the culture isn't there. So, you know, I really made a huge effort to recruit writers and get this thing out, and the response has been amazing. What it taught me is that there's been a craving for this, but I think people have been almost abused, like, you know, like an abusive relationship with the people who have been in charge of purveying our culture to the audience, because it's been so slandered and demonized in academia and media today. So the writers are coming out of the woodwork as the audience grows, and the audience has been so much more enthusiastic than I ever imagined that it would be.
That's really good to hear, because it looks like a very professional publication.
Thank you.
How long does it take to edit and lay out an issue, and where do you get the art from? It's strikingly beautiful, the large amount of classic art you use in it.
I get the art basically from the internet, and I try to find... Most people have been happy with it. There definitely have been some sticklers and nitpickers who don't think that the image quality is great in every image. And, you know, I've been doing this no budget. It's all just me, independent. So I can't pay for every image. But at the same time, you have to avoid copyright infringement, which is great for this topic, because most of this, I'm talking about history that's in the public domain. I had briefly been a library student in graduate school, and I had, you know, got looked into public domain and all of that. So I can figure out if something's in the public domain or if it's not. And if it's in the public domain, you can use it and you don't have to worry about copyright. So that works out wonderful for this particular format. Oh, how long does it take me? It really depends, because editing is kind of an arduous and tedious process, and the layout does... I'm only doing one every other month, not every month, because it's a lot of tedious work, and writing is art in a way, because you're creating, and if you're that kind of a mind or a personality, the tedium gets really monotonous and overwhelming, so I just can't... Once I put an issue out, it's so much work that I kind of have to walk away from it and do something else for a little while. And it's definitely weeks of work. It's weeks of editing things as they come in. And then I guess after an issue comes out, then I can take that break and I can do my own reading and my own writing, which is also part of the magazine itself. I mean, it's an ongoing thing. It's definitely, I would say, several weeks per issue.
So one of the things that I have been interested in is right-wing politics, or not even necessarily right-wing politics, but this as a movement, not simply as a political revolt or as a consumer revolt and things like as Gamergate was, and it's often compared to the right today. I view this as a cultural movement, and I was wondering, how do you view what you're doing as an element of this cultural movement, and what do you think kicked this off? Do you think that this is one of those cases where we are simply dealing with an idea whose time has come, or is this something that has been driven by certain influential people?
You mean, do you think the movement has been driven by influential people, or the events that caused us to react?
Well, the events that caused us to react, are we reacting to the degradation of our culture? Is this a generational move away from the baby boomers who really seem to reject the idea of culture in favor of an economic model of man? And is it our generation that seems to be taking back our culture? And are we looking for our folklore, our music, the essence of white identity and European identity? Is that something that you see as a cultural movement? And how do you view yourself as a part of that cultural movement?
Well, the inspiration for Europa Sun came directly from the Romantic movement. And the Romantic movement was something I studied in college. And again, this is where my training in history and my training in literature come full circle in what I'm doing, because I studied the Romantics in literature. And that's also where I learned to do literary analysis and look deeper into things. So that's why I try to make most of my writing not just like a regurgitation of facts. I try to actually put some analysis into it and find depth in what I'm reporting on. But the Romantic era, we touched on it briefly, but it was, I mean, there's a strong analogy there, because industrialization and the movement of people and the threat to culture, this happened then too. And the Romantic era was preceded the political nationalist movement, and it was a doubling down on culture, and it was a revival of culture, or flourishing of culture. That's where Wagner stems from, the Romantic era. You've got poetry, literature, music, even Tchaikovsky, I think, comes from that same sort of era. Visual art, the pre-Raphaelites in the UK. Then you've got the Jugendstil movement in Germany and Czechoslovakia. And they were part of the Art Nouveau movement, which was all part of this embracing our culture and doubling down on it. And nationalism at that time was birthed from that. But I think that the difference between then and now was the erosion of culture was due to scientific advancements, and the movement of people was for a pragmatic reason at that time. So therefore, the reaction to it was the cultural movement came first, and nationalism came later. But what we're seeing right now has been a direct assault on us as both an ethnicity and a culture, and an ethnoculture, which is those two things combined. And because we were basically goaded into angry reactivity, the political response came first. So my role that I view, and that was my actual inspiration and motivation and what I'm literally working for, is to add that cultural element to the socio-political movement that's already here. Because when you look at when this happened the first time, I don't believe that there would have been nationalist successes if the Romantic movement, which was the cultural movement, didn't create a cradle for that, prepping the society with art, with visuals, with music, with the folklore, rekindling that love for your cultural heritage, which is what allowed the political takeover to happen. So the alt-right came along, and it really, in the initial stages, was more of like an angry reaction, which is, I'm not putting that down at all, because that was necessary and that was natural. But I don't think we're really going to do what we need to do if we're operating only on angry reactivity. And in fact, that will cause a burnout and a fizzle out. So I'm glad that that happened. We needed it. I went through that. We probably all went through that. But I think it's time to actually build the movement on something with depth. And that is, I mean, anger is good to get things started, to kick the hornet's nest, get things moving. But we need to be rooted in our culture and in our heritage. And that's where we're going to find our salvation, I think. And so that's when you ask me what my role is or what I'm trying to do, that's what I'm trying to do. I want to be a part of a cultural revival and a flourishing of ethnic European culture.
But we use the phrase around here, restore Western civilization. Because if I had to encapsulate my goal, that's it. I want to go create something like the ancient Greeks had, like the ancient Romans had before things went bad. Something that people can really look up to that has a transcendent beauty to it.
Mm-hmm.
So sort of tangential-ish to that topic, not really. Do you have any influences in literature, philosophy, music, and art that really guide your writing as well? I mean, I know you mentioned some things that I remember from literature, like some of the Faulknerian topics about the progress of industry gradually eating up the countryside and the people's belief in everything, including God and themselves. Do you have some influences like that?
When I was younger, I was really into Shakespeare in high school. I mean, even when we weren't studying it in school, I used to just read it on my own time. And I actually picked up Chaucer on my own when it wasn't covered in my high school and read it on my own time. So I just always had an interest in deep roots of my heritage, which I'm mostly English-German heritage, but the most strong heritage that I've always identified with has been British. So I've always had this interest in that, but I've always been interested also in beauty in language, which I have two poetry books out, and that's why I include a poetry section in the magazine, because to me it's another art form. I mean, you've got visual art, you've got music, poetry is art in words. So I always felt that Shakespeare's poetry, and I was also always really drawn to Poe's poetry because I found it very lyrical and mysterious and beautiful and kind of fantasy inspired, which also is probably a little bit of the draw to folklore because folklore has an element of fantasy in it as well, which I think we need as a society. I think to be a rationalist and to cut out the fantasy and the mystical, that's wrong too. We need, this is beauty, it's fun. I mean, and you can't have a cultural movement that's just lacking in fun. You need that kind of thing. So I read The Hobbit when I was in high school, and so I was really excited when Lord of the Rings came out because I mean, I watched those religiously when they came out because, again, this was, and I could see the deep culture in that and the heritage that Tolkien put into his work, the research into the mythology and the beliefs of our ancestors. So in recent years, I've just read a lot more folklore, so I haven't been reading a lot of big-time authors now, but the folklore is the literature of the people, the oral literature of the people, which is almost like a collective canon. So to me, that's really interesting to me, too.
So it seems to me that a lot of people understand that we're going through a kind of Kali Yuga period, I think is how you'd pronounce that, or that we are essentially going through the death throes of Western civilization that I think we were probably put on with the principles of the Enlightenment, getting us away from the essential nature of Europe and European history and heritage. In your opinion, can the West be saved, or should we simply start preparing to rebuild it? And if so, what tools do we use to save it or to rebuild it?
Well, I do pay attention to the elections that are going on in Europe, and I think people who are quote-unquote black-pilled, or they're nihilists, I don't think they're doing us any favors because we have seen successes. A lot of people in the right wing are not happy with Trump, or they want their political leader to agree on everything or certain controversial topics that you can't say as the world leader right now, or certain groups that are associated with globalism and the Frankfurt School and George Soros and all of that. And as a world leader, you can't call that out. So I think when people look to somebody like Trump and they see that he's doing some things, but he's not blazing as they want him to be with everything, I don't think that that's realistic or fair. I think that we made huge progress with him. I think even though Brexit hasn't happened yet, that the vote and the result is huge. Even though the AfD in Germany didn't win the national election, they won regionally. It was all over the news that the left was freaking out that the far right is now in government. They're in government at the national level. They did win elections, but they didn't win the chancellery. But they're also in the local governments in certain places now in a way that they've never been before. Even in France, Le Pen didn't win, but her party took seats in government. So this is an advancement. And then when you look at the EU, well, yeah, the EU is the evil empire. Absolutely. But you've got Poland, and you've got Hungary, and you've got the Czech Republic and Slovakia. Those four together are known as the Visegrad Bloc or the Visegrad Group, and they're standing together. So the EU, I mean, they're in a precarious situation. They've got these four, and they're tiny countries. If it was just one of them alone, they wouldn't really be able to do much, but they're standing together. They're not going to back down. You add that to Brexit. Once Brexit finally goes through, then you add that to the fact that these nationalist parties did make gains in Germany and France, even though the far right tends to downplay that. That's huge. That's important. Are making progress. I don't believe in the black pill at all. Norway just this year elected another right-wing government. So I do think there's hope. I think there's absolutely hope. I think that we need to keep on the pressure, keep on the momentum. And that's where I think the cultural aspect comes in, because our momentum can't run on anger and reactivity forever. So we need something else to keep up the momentum. And I think that celebrating our culture and getting excited about it and remembering who we are and making our identity our driving force is a way to keep that momentum going. And if we do that, we're unstoppable. We're on the way right now. It's just a matter of keeping it up.
That, I think, is a great position statement, because we are all wondering what should happen. The term I use for Trump is baby steps.
Mm-hmm.
We need to take little steps to get to where we're going to go, and it's not all going to happen in one moment, and it probably shouldn't. People need to wrap their heads around it and become comfortable with each level of the change that's happening, because it's going to be pretty profound. And if we went straight to the ideal state, which we're not even sure what it is in most cases, we'd probably have profound vertigo. This has been, so far, an absolutely wonderful interview. And I think we're getting toward the end of the time limit where most people kind of keel over exhausted.
Mm-hmm.
And you've done great.
Thank you.
So I was going to pitch you a nice softball question on the last one. And that is number 15. If people are interested in your work, where do they find more about you, and how do they stay on top of your latest doings?
Thank you for asking me that, because I'm new to the podcasting world and everybody keeps forgetting to ask me that question. Well, I have a website. It's carolynemmerich.com, and I'm on Amazon, and Europa Sun is on. I don't know why, if you type in Europa Sun magazine, it doesn't like to come up, but if you just type Europa Sun, that'll come up. You could type in Carolyn Emmerich, that'll come up. I'm on YouTube. It's youtube.com/Carolyn Emmerich. I'm on Twitter as the Völkisch Folklorist, and that's at Carolyn Emmerich. I'm on Gab as at Carolyn Emmerich, so I'm really easy to find.
And I think this is a wonderful interview. I love talking to you, Carolyn. I love getting to know you on Gab, and I'm really happy that I found your work, and this has just been excellent. This is something that I think we really need, a cultural renewal, a spiritual renewal. I think is something that we absolutely need. We need white pills this year. We need 2018 to be a year of white pills, and I think you're a great one for this movement. So with that, for Brett Stevens, my name is Everett Foster. We would like to thank you for tuning in to Nationalist Public Radio.